So again, this is Dr. Will Horton. I'm recording. But when this lockdown started a while ago, everything got thrown into a lot of turmoil, obviously. And some of us that have been doing stuff online, at least we were blessed to be set up to do some things, to be ready to start doing, you know, whether it's therapy or sessions, if whatever you want to call it, online, and also maybe even some of the trainings. And like I said, because of what I've been doing the last few years, I've been lucky that I've been very comfortable with Zoom. I used to use GoToMeeting. Of course, now there's new platforms. I stay with Zoom because I like the recording aspects of it. That's the biggest reason I like Zoom. I love the recordings. And there are new ones we'll talk about. But today we're going to do a basic review of NLP. So why not do that in the time that we have where we're still somewhat locked down? Good news here in the wonderful state of Florida. They're starting to open up, especially next Monday, day after tomorrow on Monday. I can actually go back to the health club. But we'll talk about that and have some other stuff. So today we're going to do a basic review of NLP. So one of the things when you first get started, we're going to go back and talk about the basics. And one of the things to think about is, as within, so without, your internal state and your internal representations, how you're representing things inside your head, which controls your internal state, which in effect will control your external behavior. Also, your internal state, if you're in a good mood, your internal representations get better. The best one there, people always point to, is if you've ever fallen in love, everything's beautiful. I could sing that song, but I won't bore you with it, you know, but the flowers are sweeter, you're walking on air, da-da-da-da-da, because it changes your internal representation. And you feel better. Your external behavior bounces around, right? So it's kind of cool. And at the same time, if you do something externally, if you do a behavior externally, it changes your internal state and your external behavior. Today I sent out a thing is that sometimes things aren't as tough as until you think they are, so to speak, you know, because we think they're tough because you haven't done them. Once you do them, you find out they're not tough. And again, that's external behavior changes your internal state. So that's what we're going to do. Just a fun, fast review to get us started and have some fun with it. I always start a basic review with the eyes have it. You know, how you move your eyes tells you what part of your brain you're accessing. Very basic stuff. But I'm going to get to why I want to stress why it's so important to do the basics, right? And have some fun with it. But the eyes have it. You know, how you move your eyes tells you what part of your brain you're accessing. I don't put much credence, as a lot of you know, on whether you're accessing a memory or whether you're accessing making something up in your head. I like visual if you look up, auditory if you look side to side, and if you look down, you're either feeling something or you're talking to yourself. You're either feeling something or talking to yourself. You know, as my other big passion in life, one of my other big passions is acting. And a lot of times you see actors do two things. They look up a lot because they're trying to picture their line, right? Or they look down a lot because they're talking to themselves going, damn it, what's my line, right? And it's the old, it's why you always see the really good actors, their eyes don't seem to blink and their eyes never seem to move. But your eyes just tell you what part of your brain you're accessing. And for many people, you can't really access a feeling unless you look down. You know, you ask somebody how they feel about something, they'll look down because they have to go and say, I don't know. They have to check their feelings. So your eyes have it, but this ties into your representational systems. And quick review, this is basics, right? But, you know, so if you look up, you're making pictures, that's visual, but you also do some other things that we overlook. You know, that if you're a very visual person, you speak very fast, right? Because you're breathing shallow. You have a tendency to get out of breath, you know, unless you've had a couple of energy drinks trying to get going. You know, you speak fast. And since you're breathing fast, you're breathing shallow and high. And it makes you talk quicker and things like that. Also, you will point, you know, visual people point a lot. And of course, visual people love charts, graphs, pictures, you know, things have to be in order. You know, when you see a totally visual person, they, everything they wear will be more color coordinated, right? I always tell the old story. I've used it for a long time, but it's still true because I see people like this. You go to the health club and there's a couple people there that everything is perfectly aligned, you know, down to their hand towel, their sweatband on their head, and if they have on their, you know, wrist, everything's color coordinated. I'm not saying that they're not working out hard. They're working out a lot harder than most people, but everything is color coordinated. You know, they have to put everything in order. They can't stand people, things being out of order. So that's a visual person. And again, it's important to know, because when we get into how you help people, this can be one of the most overlooked things. Hearing or auditory people, their eyes move side to side, as I said. Their gestures seem to be more balanced. They speak with a more rhythm approach, more rhythmic and more like just rhythmic, right? Of course, they use words that are very auditory. They want to talk, discuss. You know, they love music. A thing I always think about truly auditory people, two things is, if they're singing along with a song, they actually know the words. That's kind of, most of us don't know the words. We think we know the words. So there's that. And also, they love music, but they can tell you why they like music. There's a big difference. And lastly, feeling people, kinesthetic people, they look down a lot. They speak more slowly. They breathe deep. You know, and it's true for kinesthetic men, they'll touch their chest, but they'll slow down and speak slowly, right? Now, you can use all of these. I hate when people say I'm a visual, I'm an auditory, I'm a kinesthetic. You use all of them. It depends what's going on at the time. And again, so when you see someone and you hear them talk and you watch how they're moving, you could tell whether they're visual, auditory, kinesthetic. This is very important if we want to influence them in any way, shape, or form as a coach, as a therapist, as a trainer, as a friend, right? Because if you're a visual person and people start talking to you about your feelings, there's a mismatch there, right? There's a mismatch there. And what's interesting, and we see this, it'll transfer over into how you communicate back at people. For those of us that play on Facebook, there's an interesting phenomenon going on. Everybody's arguing about all kinds of stuff on Facebook, but someone will post something because, and they'll, in their posting, it'll say like, this is what they see happening. Don't you see this happening? Don't you see that? And then people write back, yeah, but I don't feel that's correct. Right? So there's, and if you want to answer back to either one, if you post back to the person that says what they see, you have to post about what they see. And if the person that's what they feel, you post about what they feel. Not that. But we don't do that because we default to our primary system, right? And these are the keys to the kingdom. This is why I stress this. It's one of the most overlooked aspects of NLP. Yeah, because people get caught up in being fancy. I want to do the fancy stuff, the waking hypnosis, the bypass the critical factors that way, right? We forget that the basic stuff works, you know? And you have to really understand the basics to do the fancy stuff, right? You know, martial arts analogy, I can't teach you a spinning hook kick till you know a front kick, a side kick, a hook kick. Then we can maybe put it all together, right? But if you try to jump to that, you don't understand it. And when you understand the person that you're talking to, whether the visual, auditory, or kinesthetic, it's the first level of opening up someone's mind, right? And it gives you the blueprint. But again, the more we're into NLP, the longer we're into NLP and hypnosis, the easier it is to put this on the back burner and want to jump into doing something fancy. And I always default to the Princeton seminar study when it comes to the need to do the basics. And the Princeton seminar study, for those that don't know it, it's a great study. And what it is let me check the text here. Okay. The seminar study is there were some seminary students, you know, students that wanted to be preachers or ministers or whatever, whatever priests, whatever they were going to be. And they were at Princeton University. And so they're studying, you know, to become ministers. And excuse me. And so they bring them in one day and they say, here's your assignment. Everyone here is going to go give a talk or a lecture or a sermon, whatever you want to call it, right? You're going to go preach on the Good Samaritan, you know, from the Bible, the Good Samaritan. And, you know, how Jesus, you know, about being a Good Samaritan. So they kind of give a review, and then they were given some time to study and think about how are they going to present their little talk on the Good Samaritan. And they were given parameters, so it made sense for a college, like you got 20 minutes, whatever it was, and you got a group of people you're going to preach to. Great. Great. So they get ready to leave, and then the person leading it goes, oh, by the way, we're sorry, we ran over. You've only got like 5 minutes to get to the place you're going to give this, where you're going to give the talk, you're going to preach. But it was about an 8-minute walk at best, right? If you walked really fast, you couldn't get there in 5 minutes. They set that up. And what they did is then they went and got some actors from the theater department, and they were there to be people that needed help, wounded, sick, lost, etc. And so that was that. And each one of the people that was going to go preach had one or two people that needed help in front of them. None of the people that were going to go preach on the Good Samaritan, being a Good Samaritan, why it was so important, did it. They would avoid people. They'd say, I'm too busy. I got something I have to do, yada, 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 including one or two people literally would step over someone that had fallen down and looked injured because they had to get into the place to go give a talk, give a preach, whatever you want to call it. And so that's the example of, to me, sometimes losing, you know, the forest for the trees. You got your task in front of you, you lose the overall big picture. And that's what also happens to those of us when we learn NLP and hypnosis. And the more we get into it and we learn, you know, waking hypnosis, covert stuff, how to do this and how to do that, we lose the basics. Sometimes we have to back up and do the basics. Even if it's grab a manual and look at some of the basic techniques. Have you ever been to a conference? For those of us who have been in the field a long time, I could ask Mona, I could ask Billy, I could ask Laura, the beautiful Laura King, anybody. If you ever been to a conference and you learn something new, like a really cool technique, and you go, this is really cool. This is really, really cool, right? And then you go home and you practice it a couple times. You go, this is awesome. And then something happens. And you get back to doing the things you usually do. And then a few months later, you pick up notes from the conference and you go, oh yeah, I forgot about this technique. Wonder why I quit doing it. Well, you quit doing it because you moved back to the things you were doing before, or you had the next shiny toy in front of you. You know, it's why I always say I see people at a conference when we used to have conferences. Hopefully they're coming back. But this year, you know, they just learned NLP. NLP is the answer to everything. You know, year before, they just learned hypnosis. Hypnosis is the answer to everything. Then next year, they learn EFT. EFT is the answer to everything. They move from one to the other to the other, right? So you're constantly doing new things. That's great. But if you're going to really master a subject, you need to go back and do the basics over and over again. The last thing I always say, the reason we want to do the basics at each level and go over it, whether it's basic or master level kind of stuff, much like the seminary study, it's, you know, when you're in the martial arts and you go to a martial arts seminar, it's, and I've done many of those over the years, it's not unusual. You'll spend the first couple hours just reviewing a very basic technique, a front kick, a punch, how you move, a block, whatever it is. You've been doing it maybe for 25 years, but you go back and you do the basics over and over and over again. Same way professional athletes, after they take some time off, when they come back to get ready to go play golf or football, baseball, basketball, cricket for my people in India, whatever it is, you know, they go back and they review the basics. So that's why we're doing this today. and why we're having some fun with it. So you want to make sure you do the eye axis and cues, right? And then the next level is people get all caught up in techniques and they lose rapport. They want to jump into doing some technique, especially if they have a lot of experience, and now they want to jump in and do a fancy waking hypnosis technique or a fancy something, I would just call it fancy, and they will lose rapport. Those of us, again, that go to conferences can say we've seen a lot of people that supposedly master trainers, master this and that, and they'll be talking to somebody, and if you're watching from a distance, you can see they have absolutely no rapport, none. They're not mirroring, they're not matching. They didn't listen to whether the person was visual, auditory, kinesthetic, right? And so what happens when this happens, you come across as a bully, or you're manipulative, or you're condescending, right? And of course, that shuts down the feedback loop. The reason you want to have the rapport with someone is it opens up the feedback loop. You know, and if you use their rep systems, that's the first level of rapport, right? Mirroring and matching, physical mirroring and matching. And the next is the language. Are they visual? Are they auditory? Are they kinesthetic? If you match the visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and you're as much as you can physically mirroring and matching them, it gives you more information at the start, right? And it makes you realize everybody is totally cool. They're unique. They're special. Play into that. So if you're going to do rapport and you're going to mirror and match somebody, because mirror and matching is the number one rule of rapport. Again, a very basic technique. You know, when we get back to actually meeting human beings live and in person again, when you see someone and they're talking to somebody and they're in rapport, they present a mirror image of each other. Right? And this happens naturally. And it's based in your neurology. As my friend Captain Billy would say, you know, it's part of your neurological evolutionary process, because for most of millennia, your brain had to be able to adapt very quickly to figuring out, if I'm talking to somebody, are you a threat or are you an ally? You know, can I trust you or are you a threat? And this runs deeper than your conscious mind. Right? And so if you mirror match somebody, and especially if you meet somebody and they don't know you, so you're kind of a blank slate. So deep in their mind, beyond their consciousness, they're trying to say, are you a friend? Or are you a foe? Are you part of my tribe? Or are you part of my enemy? So you're trying to figure this out. And if you present a mirror image, thus we call them mirror neurons, your brain goes, oh, they're part of my tribe. They're part of my group. They're part of my culture. And, you know, and you'll look for those cues, you know. Are you dressed like I'm dressed? Are you using the words I use? And again, and if you add in the visual, the auditory, the kinesthetic, your brain, especially for someone that doesn't know you, puts you into that slot of, oh, yeah, I know you. I can trust you. Cool, right? And for this to work, if you want to get in rapport, you have to enter into a state yourself, right? And so, you know, again, these mirror neurons, they're just the way they work. And one of the other big mistakes I see people make is when I teach this, they go, yeah, but you got to be really subtle. You got to be subtle. Got to be subtle. I just want to slap. That's not rapport, but I want to just slap when I hear that, because human beings are not subtle in anything that they do, right? When people are truly in rapport, they'll mirror match exactly. I was teaching last year at the NGH, when there was a lady, and I kind of got into a spirited discussion about, you want to be real subtle because, you know, if you don't, the person you're talking to will be uncomfortable. They'll know you're doing it. First of all, she fell into the law of thinking that everyone knows what you know. The fact is, only about 0.5% of the population even understand how mirror matching actually works. So anyway, we had this discussion. I said, well, if you choose to be subtle, you can be subtle. But anyway, we all go to break. And those of us who've been to the National Guild of Hypnotists conference, at one point it was the largest hypnosis conference in the world. Mona, then on there, Billy, Laura King. I think there's some others on here that have been to the National Guild. But anyway, we go to break and everybody's getting their coffee, going to the bathroom. Anyway, coming back, this lady had run into somebody from the conference that she obviously was very good friends with, but only sees it like a conference. And suddenly, you know, after they hug, back when you could hug, after they hug, they're standing there talking. And if you're looking from a distance, they were presenting a mirror image of each other. You know, the one lady would brush her hair back. The other lady would brush her hair back. The one would go, oh, it's, oh, I love you so much. Oh, I love you so much. It was, they were presenting a mirror image. So the lady that was just arguing with me that you need to be subtle in the real world, boom, right there it is, right? So if you practice the mirroring and matching, you know, it works comfortably. It works wonderfully. And if you get people to play into whatever their rules, beliefs, and attitudes are by asking about things they really believe, things they love, their family, their true hobbies, they'll drop, even if they're trained in this stuff, they'll drop a lot of their guard, if you want to call it that, their conscious defense mechanisms, and they'll default back to the person that they really are because they hide them in plain sight. Here's a quick rapport trick I've been teaching in the last couple of years. And you could do this for singles or group, by the way. I call a future rapport. So if you're going to meet somebody you don't know and you want to really practice mirroring and matching them, right? The other day I had to go meet somebody and I was a little nervous about it because I didn't know them. So, you know, it's like, and I was going to use the all this stuff. So what I do is what I teach my people is I go inside my head, or you have your person, like you guys, go inside your head and think about somebody you have great rapport with. So I thought about my buddy Bill, right, who I've known for 35 years, one of the few people in the world, not in our field, by the way, one of the few people in the world that I would tell 99% of my life to, and I'm very comfortable with him, right, and I don't worry about anything. Right. So I imagine, okay, when I meet this guy, Dr. whatever his name was, I'll just call him X, Dr. X. I'm going to picture he's Bill. Right. And that, what I think that does is it opens up my energy. It leads me to naturally mirroring and matching him, smiling, being relaxed. And then I imagine when I walked up to meet the guy, and, you know, we didn't shake hands because of the current environment, but I nodded, he nodded, and then we sat down to talk. I was mirroring and matching him exactly from a few feet away because, right? But it's like, and I was very comfortable with it, right? And worked great, you know, because he even made the comment, wow, you know, it's like, I know we just met, but it's like I've known you for a long time. Hey, he wanted to know, maybe I met him at one of the psychological conferences here in Florida or at the American Psychological Association. I said, no, I don't think so. He said, I just feel like I know you. That's when you know it worked, right? I'd reeled him in, right? So that's a rapport technique. And then the next thing you want to do, oh, vastly overlooked, is the basic information gathering. I call it the meta model. Some NLP groups call it well-formedness conditions, but it's basically 8 questions, give or take, you know, that focuses your target's mind. Again, everything goes back to, do you have rapport with your client or the person that you're talking, the target, your client, the person you're talking to, right? And if you do, they're much more likely to answer the questions because they've dropped their guard. You're part of my community. I need to tell you this information, right? And the questions have not changed, you know, they've not changed in forever because they work, right? And the basic questions are, what do you want? And what will that do for you specifically? So if you're talking to somebody and you ask, so what do you want, Joe or Mary, whatever, whoever you're talking to? Again, you're marrying and matching. If you've talked to them and maybe you know, that they're visual. So what do you want, Mary? What do you see happening? And they'll tell you. You know, and so what would that do for you specifically? You know, and what else would it do for you? Right? So what do you want? What would that do for you? And then you always throw in, what else would it do for you? Because many times the mistake people make, and we see it all the time, is you ask somebody, what do they want? And they say, I want to lose weight. Here's what you ought to do. And they'll default to whatever they think people ought to do to lose weight, right? Without asking the second question, what would it do for you, right? What are you going to do, right? So if it's what do you want, and then you ask, what would that do for you? So they say they want to lose weight. Great, great, I can understand that. So, and let's say they, you know, they're visual. So what do you want? You know, and they say, I want to lose weight. Great. Well, what would that do for you specifically? How will you see that it's working? They'll tell you some other things, right? And so now you've gotten more information. Maybe you've got, begin to get the information you need so they can really get what they want. A classic one in the hypnosis world is someone says they want to lose weight. Well, what would that do for you? And they say, oh, it'll make me more confident. Really? Really? You know, had this talk with Tom Nicoli, a whole bunch of people that do a lot of weight loss. Not really. They'll just be skinny and they'll have no weight, no confidence, right? And then they'll end up getting fat again because I thought I would have confidence. I don't have confidence, right? But if you give them confidence, they may lose the weight even if you never mention food, right? So what would that do for you? You know, what do you want? What would that do for you? What else would it do for you? You know, I tell people anymore, you can ask that question several times. Anything else it'll do for you? What else would it do for you, right? And then you always ask, you know, how will you know when you have it? What will you see, hear, or feel, taste, or smell? What's your physical evidence you've got that goal, right? Because every once in a while you're talking to somebody and they want an esoteric goal. I want to be happy. You know, I want to feel fulfilled. What the hell does that mean? What the hell's happy? What the hell's fulfilled? You know, and you ask, well, how will you know when you have it? I'll just know. Well, they have no empirical data, no evidence for whatever this goal is that they want. They'll probably never get that goal because they have no evidence for it, right? And sometimes they have to dig down and say, that's how I know I have it, right? And you see this a lot in our cultures where people think having a lot of money will make them feel good. Well, how will you know you're happy? You know, having money, what will it do for it? Make me feel better. Well, how will you know you feel better? I'll have a lot of money. Well, they get a lot of money, they don't feel better, right? And even if they thought they, now they got the fake evidence that they want, and really what they want to do is feel better, and they've tagged in the money for it, but the money will never make them feel better. So you can get into these circles. You know, and then we always want to ask if it's appropriate, how will this affect other people in your life? You know, that comes from Virginia Satir, because if you change, if you want to lose weight and you decide you're going on a plant-based vegan diet, great. That's wonderful. But if you're married or you got a spouse and you got a bunch of kids, maybe they don't want to go on a plant-based vegan diet. So it could cause some other things. You know, I always say, how will this affect other people? And do you care? You know, I just had this with somebody because I still see random people. I don't know how this person found me. They wanted to stop smoking. And I said, okay, how will this affect? We got down to this and we got the information. Okay, fine. I said, well, you're married, right? And does your spouse smoke? Yes. Well, you stopping, how's this going to affect? Well, what do you mean? Well, will your spouse be supportive of you stopping smoking? You know, are you sure? Because it'll affect them. And they hadn't thought about it. I said, well, that's something you might want to think about because, you know, I don't know. I see it all the time. You know, people that you think are going to be supportive are not. You know, I really believe in the power of this question after working in addictions for over 35 years. Because people go into treatment, they go to get off alcohol or drugs or smoking, and oh, everybody will be supportive. Ha ha ha, as I say. Ha ha. Right? No, they're not. You're drinking buddies. I liked you better when you were drunk. You know? I just had a guy who's in our field, so I won't say, but he quit drinking. And we were talking, doing a follow-up session, and he goes, yeah, you know, he's had to cut some friends out of his life because a couple of them said, you were more fun when you were drunk. Yeah. And I go, well, what does that mean to you? He goes, well, it means I would pick up the tab, more. You know, he goes, now I'm out with them and they're having a bunch of beers. I'm not buying a round. I'm drinking a soda. I'm not buying, you know, 12 beers, buddy. You know, and they're slug anyway. So this will affect other people. What stops you from already having this? You know, what stops you? You know, and we don't ask that enough, I think. What resources do you have? Right? Many, you know, they always say that you have all the resources you need. I'm not quite sure if that's true or not. I think we have most of the resources that we need. But part of our job maybe is to give people resources. Sometimes people have, this sounds weird, the access to too much conflicting information, right? And I always think of weight loss when I think of that one, because there's a lot of resources about weight loss. You know, the only way to lose weight is the Atkins diet or the Zone diet or the healthy heart diet or the Mediterranean diet or be. Sometimes people just shut down. You know, I see it in the addiction world, because for years people go, well, for a while there was only one way to sober up if you were an alcohol or drugs, and that was the 12-step program. Now, well, there's the 12-step program. There's risk reduction program. There's this program. There's that. Sometimes people just need help figuring out what resource fits them best. What resource fits you? You know, and I'll give you an example from my world where if they're trying to overcome an addiction, especially alcohol or drugs, I go, are you social? Were you a bar drinker? Did you like to party at bars? Yes. Okay. You might like the 12-step program because it'll give you a social outlet. Because if you take away, let's say they were an alcoholic, you take away the alcohol and they're not going to the bar anymore. Now they've got a hole in their life they need filled. You know, if you go around a 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous, generally you'll find a lot of the people sitting in the room were the type of people that went to bars. You get a few like people that drank in their home, but not many. Same with Narcotics Anonymous. You got the people that like to get high in groups and go to concerts. It's because it's the fellowship. It's the social aspect of the program. But if you were totally isolated drinker, you didn't want people to know you drank or get high, you hid in your house and do it, making you go to a 12-step meeting is like pulling a tooth. You know? So they need resources in different ways. And then we help them get additional resources. So if you ask people these questions, you know, what do you want? What would that do for you? What else would it do for you? How will you know when you have it? What will you see, hear, or feel, smell, or taste? What's your evidence? How will this affect all the other people in your life, including coworkers, family members, everybody? What stops you from having this already? What resources do you have that will help? And if you have a lot of resources, do you have conflicting information is part of the problem, right? Which kind of a one way to look at conflicting information is the entire world's experiencing it now with COVID-19. You know, one expert will say this, and then one expert will say that. So and then another expert will say it's in the middle, and another expert will say, so at the end you got like, and they're all experts. And if you read if you can find the research, the truth, it's like there's conflicting information. So, you know, so then we help them get there. So, you know, those are some of the most basic fun things that you have to do when it comes to learning NLP. And I'm glad my friend Captain Billy's on the line. Because this is a lot of his work. A few years ago, we started looking at, you know, ways to teach hypnosis and NLP. And he's a research psychologist, I guess is what I'd call him, you know. I'm not sure what I'd call him in public. Sorry. Whew, tough crowd. I'm here till Friday.
Please be nice, Will. Please be nice.
Yeah. Anyway, him and I, and a lot of this was his work, and, you know, he came up with the natural theory. And what the natural theory is disassociation is integral. It's a key piece to NLP or hypnosis because it helps you better deal with threats, because your brain's number one job is to keep your butt alive. It's constantly searching the external world to keep you alive. That's its deepest default mechanism, right? If you go through combat training, fight training, anything like that, they put you in situations to override that. And it's hard because you will default to survival mode, right? You will default to survival mode. Again, we're kind of seeing it now, right? And it's about how to better deal with threats, right? And in one ways to think about it is disassociation of conscious and non-conscious processes, the things you can consciously think about, the higher level thought, if you can disassociate that from the underlying things, you know, then you can disrupt the flow of info. And we call it the HOT model, the hierarchy of thought. And this kind of explains how NLP and hypnosis works, right? It kind of explains how NLP and hypnosis works. You know, I know when we started talking about this to some people, they were very excited. Unfortunately, some of the organizations didn't grasp the idea quite as much as they could have, but it kind of explains how hypnosis and NLP works. And it's very simple. It's not that hard, right? And what it is we have three basic levels of thought, right? Three levels of thought. The first level is you're in an experience. And when you're in the experience, if it's a strong experience, that's all you can do. It will override even your conscious processes. When you're hungry and you're physically hungry, you're in the experience of being hungry. And then you'll do anything to help that experience. You'll eat. I mean, that's why they, you know, I would say your diet goes great when you start on Monday morning. And then Monday afternoon, you eat a donut because you let yourself get hungry. Right? So you're in the experience. When you're in the experience, that's basically all that's happening. And if it's a highly charged emotional experience, it will shut down everything else. Right? And it's just what we're seeing in the real world right now. I kind of want to do this today because with everything happening, we see it. The other day I was at the store and the pet store, which is an essential service. And, you know, I went to get the food. I had to get the bird food, and I'm coming up, and there was a lady there, right? And she had a mask. She had a goggles on, double gloves. She was terrified and absolute terror. When I looked in her eyes, I come around the corner. She's in line, and it wasn't fear. It was terror. You know, a few of us on this call have seen and experienced terror, right? And she was terrified, right? Because I come around the corner, she looks, so she jumps to move, but there was somebody a few feet the other way, and you could see it. My heart went out to her, right? Especially I'm standing there. I got no mask. I got no gloves. I got no glasses, you know, because I understand how closed air system worked. But anyway, so I'm like, I felt for her. She was in the experience of fear and terror. Everything was a threat. I was a threat, you know. Everything was a threat. So when you're in the experience, that's all you are, right? And then the second level of thought is you disassociate from the experience. Like the first, let's say when you're hungry and you're in and you start thinking about, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry. If you pull back and think, oh, I think I'm hungry, or am I really hungry? And those of us do weight loss stuff with people, like most hypnotists, helpers, psychologists, right? A lot of times you're eating because you're bored or you're angry or there's nothing to do. That's why a lot of people gain weight in this lockdown, in this house arrest, right? Are you really hungry, or, you know, this is the time I usually normal jump in the truck and go do something. Nope, can't do that. So, I'm hungry. No, I'm not. And if you pull back, no, I'm bored. I'm angry. I'm depressed, whatever it is. Or like the lady, if she could have pulled out of the experience of terror and realized, you know, there's things beyond her. I don't know. But if she'd have pulled out of the experience of being terrified and thought about, am I really terrified? What is the true threat matrix? You know, to use Captain Billy's terms. What is the true threat matrix here? You know? And again, I don't know, maybe she had an underlying comorbid disorder. I have no idea. But but when you pull out of the experience, you're at the next level. Then you can make conscious choices. You know, the other day when I was looking in the refrigerator freezer to get ice cream because I thought I was hungry, and I did step back and go, I'm not really hungry. I just, you know, I'm just bored. I need to do something, you know? And then I could go do something else. And I did. I went and did an extra round of Taibo or something, right? And so that's the second level. The third level is you thinking about it. So you have your first level, you're in the experience. Second level, you're thinking about the experience. The third level is you're thinking about the experience. So if I had been standing in a refrigerator, I could have thought, am I hungry or do I just think I'm hungry? So it doubled disassociation, you know? And at this level, you can get all kinds of things going on. It's how you can get hallucinations, number blocks, all this stuff, because you're not thinking about the experience, you know? Even though you're standing there and your eyeglasses are, my eyeglasses are right there, I'll be going, where are my glasses? Where are my glasses? You know, I'm asking, where are my glasses? What did I do with my glasses? Where did I put them? So my brain is doing all this other stuff. The glasses are right there. And then Christina will walk by and go, they're right there. And then I feel like an idiot, but it's what happens. Now, when you think about that, the power of this is in reverse. You know, if somebody's thinking too much, which we get a lot with hypnosis, and they're thinking about it, don't know what to do, and you put them in their body with something like a progressive relaxation, or a Dave Elman induction. That's okay. Open your eyes, close your eyes. Open your eyes, close your eyes. Relax your toes, relax your feet. Imagine your eyes relax. Cascading, whatever. It pulls them into the experience of being in their body. Right? So it pulls you out of thought and puts you in the experience. Right? But there are other times we want to pull them out of the experience and make the change. And so when you look at especially neuro-linguistic programming, a lot of it is we pull them out of the experience. So you know, every time you see a cigarette, you want to smoke. Okay, great. So the visual cue is a cigarette, right? I'll use my pen because I don't smoke. There's a cigarette, right? Makes me want to smoke, or I see the pack, I want to smoke. So if you have them pull back and imagine themselves, let's say, the ideal self, the self that would never smoke a cigarette, right? And then you have them imagine the cue picture, the how visual squish works. So they see the cigarette, maybe the pack of Marlboro, and then you have it blow up or disappear or double click, it's gone. Now you see the disassociated picture of you at your very best, the you that would never smoke, and it goes to that, right? And so you do that a couple times. You've pulled out of the experience. You've disassociated, and you're seeing yourself the way you want to be. It's disassociated, so you're moving toward it. So it sets up a loop in your brain. So then if it works perfectly, the next time you see the cue, the cigarette, you just won't have the desire. It bypasses it. I worked with a person in our field who used to, I think it was Snickers candy bars. I still love this story because he was a big stage hypnotist, still is, beautiful, brilliant stage hypnotist. And, you know, but he would do stage shows, obviously. And let's say you're doing an after prom or a, or even a show at a club or something in a town, and you're done and it's 1 a.m, there may not be a lot of places to eat, right? So he kind of had trained himself that he would get back to the hotel and get a Diet Coke. Good. But then he would get 1 or 2 Snickers bars. So he would eat the Snickers bars, right? And so we just did this technique. I thought, well, it'd be fun to see, right? And so here it is like 25 years later. And every once in a while, you know, he'll message me that he still rarely, if ever, eats a candy bar. So it can work. So these experiences, they pull you out, have you think about them differently. So when you go back in the experience, you're doing something different, right? That's also how like something like the new behavior generator works. You see it, you pull out of the experience, so you're not thinking about playing football. You're watching your idol play football or play golf the way you like, and then you imagine the swing, and then you step into the experience. So you go from disassociated to associated. And then the classic third level disassociation is something, is the fast phobia technique. You're watching yourself watch the movie, which we also use for mending a broken heart. You watch yourself watch the broken heart scenario. And then when you step back into it, it's a two-step step in. So you're up here in the highest level of thought. I'm watching myself have this negative experience. Watch myself have the negative experience. Then when I settle into watching it and then step into the movie, it's a different experience. And that's how it actually rewires some of those neural pathways. It lays down a different track in your neuroplasticity. So I think this stuff is fabulous. This explains a lot. And so it also explains when people get stuck, right? You're trying to do a relaxation on somebody and they're highly stressed and they're thinking about it. You know, and all they can think about is all the negative things at work or in their family or this, and you're trying to get them in their body, that you see where the disassociation is. It's between level one and level two. They can't experience it. Or they're in such an emotional experience, they can't pull out of it at this time. Right? I mean, when I used to have my one office, and Laura can relate to this, or Billy in beautiful DC, and I'm not sure who else is on the call from where, right? But you know, you have a client and they're running a few minutes late because of traffic, right? And so they're all stressed out. Oh, like Michelle up in the Pennsylvania area, you know, it can happen to any of us, right? And so they need to like decompress because they're in the experience of I'm stressed out because I was running late, which makes them do this. And, you know, so sometimes you have to be able to help them, you know, pull out of the negative experience before you can even start if they're there for change work or you're there to help them do other things. So again, it just gives you a map of where they are and what they're doing, much like are they visual, auditory, or kinesthetic, right? So this gives us a viewpoint. So we can really have some fun with this, right? So that's kind of a quick thing, but I want to close. I told everybody I'll respect your time on this beautiful Saturday, even though a lot of us don't have a lot of places to go yet. You know, hopefully we'll start opening things up pretty soon. But let's do an exercise. And one of my favorites, and it's a very basic one because it's going to tie in everything we talked about today, right? So I thought that's why I would do this one. And let's say there's a food, maybe right now because of the lockdown, you're eating too much of, right? And because maybe it's a comfort food, might be ice cream, could be snacks, who knows? I don't judge, you know? Could be, you know, fruit, whatever it is. So we're going to change, like if it's candy or cookies or snacks, we could do like the swish pattern. But here's another one because it's going to tie in the things that we talked about. Because when you also think about like your visual, auditory, kinesthetic and how you process information, that's also another way of looking at your submodalities. So let's say if you have this, we could play with it and end our lockdown on a more positive note. So think about a food you eat too much of that you would like to eat less of. Maybe it's pasta. Maybe it's sweets, snack foods, junk foods, right? Or we could go the other way and think of a food that you need to eat more of, right? But let's get rid of a food because it's the easiest to do right now. So let's say it's bread and pasta because of the lockdown. Right, and so if you could, I'll just do a imaginary one, but join along with me, right? And that, so what I want you to do is take a nice deep breath and exhale. And what I'd like you to do is close your eyes. Just close your eyes. And as you do, I would like you to think about this food you want to eat less of, right? I'd like you to think about this food you want to eat less of. And what I'd like you to do is imagine it right in front of you. And again, I'll just say pasta. It could be anything. But how big is it right in front of you? Is it, or where is it? Is it to the left? Is it to the right? Where is it? Take your hands and kind of grab that food. Is it life size or bigger than life size? Is it color? Is it three-dimensional? Notice all the intricacies of the visual aspects of it. Is it moving or still? Like I said, is it three-dimensional or kind of flat? Is it panoramic? Does the picture seem just real? And as you're looking at it and that, how do you feel? How does it make you feel? And as you notice those feelings, where is it? In your stomach, in your taste buds, in your head? Does it have a taste? You can taste it even before you use it, eat it. Maybe you can smell it. And what do you hear in your head as you're imagining this? Maybe you hear, I can't wait. Ooh, you know, it's an extra serving. Great. And let your mind know it's okay. We're just going to play. And on a scale of 1 to 10, you imagine how much you love this food. And it just pops into your mind. Good, good. And now let your mind rest. Open your eyes, close your eyes. Now imagine a food you dislike, if not even hate. You would never eat. You know, in my case, it would be liver and onions. Other people love it, but for me, I just don't like it. Blech, right? Blech. It just gives you that. And now imagine this food you really dislike, if not hate, and let it pop into your mind. Notice the color, the shape, the sound, the feeling. Is it three-dimensional or flat? What is the size? Is it panoramic or not? Does it seem real or just blech? What do you hear in your head as you're thinking of this food you dislike? Maybe you hear or gagging. Or, and how does it make you feel? You know, how does it taste? Maybe it tastes greasy, tastes slimy. Smells rancid. You couldn't imagine eating this food. Makes you sick physically, mentally, emotionally, even spiritually. And what do you hear in your head? Like I said, yuck, oh my God, that's sick. Good. And again, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you hate or really, really dislike this food? You would never eat. Good. Now open your eyes, close your eyes. Now what I'd like you to do, and tell your brain it's okay, because we're just running an experiment. But take the food you like, and if you can, with your hands, physically begin to move that food to the location of the food you dislike. And as you do, you notice the color, the shape, the sound, the feeling. They all begin to blend and merge, kind of like when you're watching a fancy movie and the picture kind of gets blurry or whatever, and then suddenly it's a new picture. And so as you do, it changes its color, its shape, its sound, its feeling. Suddenly the good, delicious, changes to makes you hear the gagging sound. But when you heard like in your head, that goes to, oh my God, that's sickening. So move it. And as you do, the smell changes to its, like the food you hate. So now move it to the same spot. It's right exactly where the food you dislike is. Tell your brain it's okay. And it doesn't matter where you learn to like that food, from a parent or an authority figure or society, it's okay to just play with this. and I'll lock it down into that area. Great. Great. Now, just open your eyes. And now, just let your eyes move around. Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, when you think about that food that you used to love, what is the number now? Good. Well, come on back. Now, yeah, we'll see if it works. Now, if you want to reinforce that, if you're really working on something, if you wanted to reinforce it, the way you reinforce it is the next time you see that food, you know, you could think about the food you dislike. So if I was eating pasta, I'm not a pasta eater, but if I saw it and I wanted to quit eating it, next time I saw it, if I just mentally thought about like liver and onions, it would help reinforce it. Everyone stay on the call. I'm going to stop the recording in a moment and take questions, or I could take questions on, it would be fine. But all my NFNLP trainers, I have a whole bunch on the line. I can see there. You can just go to nfnlp.com. We offer the world's best, most effective, most efficient, most cost-effective and efficient, fun NLP training on the planet. You can go to nfnlp.com and see all the list of trainings. Again, I'm so proud of all the trainers and the people of NFNLP that had jumped on, started doing virtual sessions, virtual trainings, you know, whether it's Zoom or GoToMeet, whatever. I got people using different things, whatever it is. But if you go to nfnlp.com, we've been trying to keep that updated with people doing the online training. Online training is the wave of the future. I'm kind of excited about what I think we're going to see happen soon, which is hybrid trainings. So when the lockdown ends all over the world and you do a training, maybe you get 6-12 people in your room that you're training, which is great, but you could set up the camera and still do a Zoom or go to meeting, or I guess Google's offering a new meeting platform, so is Facebook, whatever you decide to use. So guess what that does? That increases your reach. That increases, so you could be in Chennai doing a class, but one of your class, because one of my people just said this happened, well, because it was virtual, their cousin wanted to take the class and they were in another country, but because it's virtual, they could log on and do it. So it opens that up. Also, it can help because what if someone, and I think we'll have to figure out how to handle this, by the way, but like you're doing a 4 or 5 day NLP training all at once and someone, you know, has to stay home that day, they could Zoom into the meeting and they could be there virtually. So I think all that's going to be fun, but especially the virtual aspect, we'll see it change. The other day, a couple weeks ago, I lose track of time. No, yeah, almost a month ago, there was a hypnosis conference, the IAC conference, International Association of Counselors and Therapists, who had for the last several years been streaming part of their conference. Well, they decided to obviously do the whole conference and it went quite smooth. And I was doing a 2 day like essentials of NLP course. And they said, would I do the essentials of NLP live via Zoom? I said, I'd love to. And the good news was I ended up getting like 3 times as many students as I would normally get because I asked the people and they said, well, they're actually there because A, they didn't have to spend 3 more nights in a hotel, right? Which is also, it was a 2 day training, but 3 nights in a hotel. And also then they didn't have to come in and spend 3 extra days away from their family or away from their friends or away from their practice. So they could just do the meeting. So I had, you know, instead of a small group, I had a much bigger group and people were from all over the country and one from Europe. So it was kind of cool. So our upcoming NLP, tomorrow we're going to do a NLP review of the master NLP, which is waking hypnosis. We'll do a review much like this, try to keep it to about an hour because I respect your time. Monday, we're doing a hypnosis and NLP trainers course review, which is kind of the start of a master trainer course, which I've got started it actually starts May 25th, but this Monday, the 18th, will be like a preview. We'll do some stuff of the of basic training. So tomorrow is master, same time, same station. Monday is the trainer's course, and maybe I'll do a few more of these on some specialty stuff. I'm having fun with it. It's keeping me active. So I'm going to stop the share there. Now everybody's back. If you want to, does anybody have a question to start? Quiet group. Dr. Rocky.
Yes. Will, thanks so much. This is amazing generosity. Thank you. The question is something which came up on our training together. Now, with isolation, we are getting into tribal identity. God save my family, gave my friends, and let everyone die. So how do we deal with that using NLP?
I don't know. I think that's, honestly, Dr. Rocky's a brilliant physician, and he's also great at improv medical stuff. I'll default to that's above my pay grade. You know, okay. I'll use Captain Billy's terminology. That's above my pay grade. That's higher level thinking. But I think we'll see it, and we'll see how it shapes out when the lockdown starts to end.
Thank you.
Good question, though. Any other questions? Any comments? If I don't see you.
Will?
Yes.
It's Robert Brienza.
Hey.
If I could make a quick comment at what the doctor had just said.
Yes.
And this is just a thought, and I could be wrong. But it seems as if the tribal identity is being driven by fear. Would we be able to help to disassociate the fear, which in essence would help to eliminate the need for the tribal identity?
That's probably the key, because once you activate the reptilian mind, all logic goes out the door, right? So, yeah, but that's... The problem with that, though, is on the flip side, when you're in fear, it's hard to pull people out of fear because they look for reasons to be fearful.
Right.
You know, because I could tell that lovely lady at the pet store looked at me like I was a complete moron because I'm standing there with no mask and no gloves. And that's like, nah, I'm fine. But, you know, I was a threat. And then any evidence to the contrary becomes a threat. So, cool. Any other questions?
Dr. Bill?
Yes.
I'll be from Chennai.
Hey.
In your work on de-addiction, especially for alcoholics, what are some of the techniques that will help them when they are recovering after a de-addiction program? During the recovery period, they are not able to sustain the changes.
That's a good question on addictions. It's one of the reasons... Usually the people I get in arguments with, Laura's seen it, Billy's seen it, with hypnosis or NLP can help get you over the hump, but then you've got some long-term structural changes people have to get into. If you've drank in bars since you were 18 years old and you're 38, and I can get you not to crave alcohol in one or two sessions, what do you do at 5 o'clock when you walk out of your office or out of the plant? And all your friends are there, you got nothing to do. So you've got to help them restructure a lot more than just not drinking. Because I will make this statement and I'll never back off. I've never seen it successful where they just put down the drink and still do things like go to bars, hang around with the same people, and do the same things. In my model of the world, I've never seen that be successful. You know? Because it's a structural change.
Okay. How do we help them then? We need to give other supportive treatment.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, whether it's their, sometimes, and it's not just the 12-step, it could be the 12-step program, it could be a religious program, it could be their family, it could be a hobby. I just had one guy, God, he's a world-class bodybuilder now. And, you know, 6 years ago, he was a crack addict. Now he's a world-class bodybuilder, right? Some people say he's addicted to bodybuilding, you know, but I'm not going to judge what they're addicted to. We all, don't look in my closet. Well, first of all, my closet has a glass door, so it doesn't really matter. So, whew, tough crowd, man. Thank you. It's a good question.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Will?
Yes.
Is there a way to, instead of eliminate a food, have better portion control? What technique would portion control be? Because for me personally, I can go back 5 or 6 times. I'm Italian, so, you know, how can I cut down on portions?
That's a good, yeah, thank you. You know, I would say, and I've seen people start to do it, where they take that, the one we just did, map across from love to disgust. What if you find a food you could just take or leave? What if you go from a food I love to I could take it or leave it? You know, if they have a food that they're, I don't want to say neutral, but like they'll eat a little bit of, what if you mapped across that way? I haven't done that much of it, but one of my people who does a lot more with eating disorders says that works like, you know, because you know, whatever, if they have a food that they really don't overeat, but they can eat. Does that make sense? You know, kind of a new, not, I don't want to say neutral, but.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, can take it or leave it.
Thank you.
Yeah, any other questions?
How could you replace the love to discuss with a cigarette? Could you give a small example of that?
I've never done it for a cigarette. Who asked?
Interesting. Interesting. Yvonne. Hi.
Hi, Yvonne. No, I've never done it with cigarette. I always use the visual swish as one of my NLP techniques for that.
Yeah, I've done that too. Yeah, but this is very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Yeah. I've never done it for that. I do, while I have someone here, I will say thank you to Mr. Billy Schilling, because he helped come up with that hot model and the naturalistic theory of hypnosis, and I spun it into NLP. Are you there? I think we're muting each other. There you go.
Yes, Will, thank you. You explained these ideas far better than I do. I'm having problems with my internet link today. It's dropped off a few times, so that's why I turned my camera off. Of course, you're there on the bridge of the Death Star, and I'm here in my stateroom on my submarine. So the lighting is very poor and indirect, as you can see, completely illuminating the blank wall behind me.
That's okay.
But thanks again.
That's okay. Yeah, your internet's intermittent because of the National Security Agency. Sorry. Had to say that. How's Miss Laura? I want to say hi to her there on the beautiful other coast. I'll let you unmute yourself.
I'm working on it. Hi. I'm good. Everything is good. Lockdown has been kind of busy, though. People like their phone sessions and their FaceTime and their Skype sessions. So not much has changed except for I get to stay home and make lunch for my husband every day now.
Okay. Cool. Let's see, who else? We got a lot of people. Anybody else? Comments, questions?
Will.
Yes.
Mark Wagner here.
Oh, hey.
Hey, man. wanted to ask if you are going to provide the recording of this today, because it would be nice to refer back to it.
Yes. That's why I recorded it. It'll be on YouTube. I'll post it on Facebook. I'll do the podcast.
Awesome. Awesome. Oh, okay. I came in a little late, so sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. Cool. Oh, yeah, people. Anything else from anybody? All right. Well, tomorrow at same time, we're going to do the master. We'll do some stuff on the master level of NLP, which for all the people that know me, know I kind of focus the master level stuff in like meta programs and subconscious communication, or some people call it waking hypnosis, but more at the next level. But, you know, first we do the basic, then we can do some of the master stuff. So that's what we're looking forward to doing. And that'll be tomorrow. Hello. Pardon?
Hello.
Hey.
How are you, Dr. Will?
Oh, good.
I just want to thank you.
Hey, how are you? How's Lebanon?
Great. I just want to thank you for this lecture.
Oh, fine.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, she was at one of my last live trainings when I was in Lebanon in October.
Yes, it was great.
Hobbling around with a torn Achilles tendon that I didn't know I tore.
Thank you.
Cool. All right, everyone. I hope you can join me tomorrow. It's going to be fun. We'll have some fun. If you have any specific questions or anything after this, let me know. I think maybe I'll set up a quick one of these, like a review of like NLP and hypnosis to treat addictions, just kind of a quick overview, how I would handle it, just, you know, what I currently think, which is in transition, because one of the things I will say, once I went back, thanks to Captain Billy and a few other people, started studying neurology, neuroplasticity, and neuromyelology, it's changed how I approach addictions. So that's kind of good. And it's okay to admit you were wrong or misinformed at the time, you know? So I'll talk to you all later. Godspeed to everybody, and have a great day.